Is this where we were? Is this where I left off? Can you hear me? Okay, then we'll start while these late students find their seats. I already talked about this slide though, right? I talked about pumps. Pumps are active transporters. I think I mentioned that the most prevalent pump in cells is the sodium-potassium exchange pump, which actively transports sodium out of the cell and potassium ions into the cell, which is what maintains both of those gradients. There is a higher concentration of sodium ions outside the cell, in other words, in the extracellular fluid, and there's a higher concentration of potassium ions inside the cell in the intracellular fluid. That's for all cells. And so that causes, one of the reasons why there is what is called a membrane potential, which is a voltage across the membrane. We'll talk more about membrane potentials later. But slide 16 just illustrates how this happens. It's a pump is just a protein. It is an example of a carrier protein. But what makes it a pump is that it uses energy in the form of ATP to move things against their concentration gradient. So it's moving sodium ions from where they're already scarce inside to where there's already a hell of a lot of them outside. At the same time, it's pumping potassium ions from where there's already comparatively scarce outside to where there's already a hell of a lot of them. It's stockpiling both of them. And both of those processes require energy because diffusion wants to make things move in exactly the opposite direction. Diffusion wants to make potassium ions go out of the cell, down their gradient. Diffusion wants to make sodium ions go into the cell, down their gradient. Figure 17 just shows you another kind of a carrier. This happens to just be a glucose transporter, but what this shows you is that if a concentration gradient is set up, which is the case for sodium ions because of the pump, which is not the one shown here. Side by side with this embedded in the plasma membrane are a bunch of these sodium-potassium pumps. The ATP that's spent on those pumps creates and maintains a sodium ion gradient. That gradient is a form of potential energy. There's energy stored in the fact that there is a gradient in place. And that energy, just like carrying water up a hill, invests that water with potential energy with respect to gravity. And if you spill that water onto a water wheel, that you're spending some of that potential energy to turn that wheel, and it can do some work for you. Similarly, if you set up an ion concentration gradient by spending ATP at one place across the membrane, then if you allow part of that concentration gradient to be dissipated, meaning if you allow some of those sodium ions to diffuse back into the cell, that spends some of that potential energy for you and it can do some work. One example of the work that it can do is to drag some other particle along with it. This, for instance, glucose in this case. So glucose can be dragged along for the ride with sodium because sodium is diffusing down its own gradient. All right? And a lot of things are secondarily actively transported this way. Secondary active transport is active transport, as the name implies, but it's secondary active transport because the ATP expenditure does not occur at the same place where that particle that's secondarily actively transported takes place. All right, so this secondary active transport is going to involve two different proteins. A pump, some sort of pump, typically a sodium-potassium exchange pump, that sets up the gradient for sodium in this case that is the potential energy that can then be used employing a different carrier protein right beside it in the plasma membrane to allow sodium to diffuse back into the cell but drag something else along with it. And that something else can be, the reason that secondary active transport is that something else that's dragged with along the ride with sodium ion is something that can be moved against its own gradient. Right? You see what I'm saying? So that something else moved against its gradient, I would normally take ATP. Well, it is taking ATP. It's just that you're not spending that ATP directly right there. You're spending ATP to set up the sodium ion gradient, and then that sodium ion gradient is driving the active transport of the other thing. Go ahead. Right, unless I have it hidden because it's a pain in the ass for me to look at. I have it hidden right now because I'm still not going to deal with this today. All right? Okay, so let's... Whoops. Let's look at slide 18 then. This is another overview of secondary active transport. It gives you a picture to make sense of what I just said. Notice that the sodium-potassium exchange pump there on this cell is where the ATP is actually spent directly. The ATP fuels the operation of that sodium-potassium pump. But the result of that pump working is that a big gradient with respect to sodium ions is created. There's a lot more outside than in. And so sodium wants to diffuse back in the cell, just like water wants that you carry up a hill, spending energy to carry up a hill, wants to flow back down the hill. So that flowing down the hill would be sodium ions diffusing back into the cell. And it can do the work of dragging something else along for the ride, like chloride ions shown right here. All right, so it's secondary active transport simply because the ATP is spent somewhere else first. And another way of saying that is that secondary active transport requires primary active transport somewhere else for it to work. Slide 19 illustrates the notion of specificity of carriers. Protein carriers, or carrier proteins, I mean, are specific, that is to say, for a certain number of correctly shaped particles. So carrier proteins don't just willy-nilly transport anything across the membrane. That something that they transport has to have the right shape in order to fit into a receptor site on the protein. Proteins work, whatever their job is, they usually work based on their shape or conformation. And specificity is not perfect, meaning that it's not necessarily just one single kind of particle that can fit there. There could be a couple or a few kinds of particles that have enough of the right shape to fit in there. And so there's another important property of mediated transport mechanisms. Mediated transport is the name given to any transport mechanism that requires intervention of a protein. So it would include facilitated diffusion, it would include primary transport, primary active transport, secondary active transport, anything that requires a protein rather than just going straight through the phospholipid bilayer. So specificity is the first important of the three properties that that mediated transport processes exhibit. Specificity is the first. The second is competition, and that's because since more than one different type of particle can fit into that shape, into that receptor site, and therefore be carried by that protein, anything with this, the right shape is going to compete for that available carrier protein. So competition is the second major property. And you can see competition illustrated here because you notice that maltose is also able to fit right into that slot. But an important thing to realize is that just because something fits into the slot doesn't mean it's going to activate the carrier protein into changing shape the correct way to drag it across. So it really is competition in the sense that some things can just block them up and therefore not allow the normally transported particle to get through because all the carrier proteins are full of these competing molecules. And so slide 20, the figure just shows you how much glucose is transported. Well, the rate of glucose transport versus the concentration. First, there are a couple important points here. When the concentration gradient is high, then a lot of glucose is transported. In other words, the steeper the gradient, the faster the transport. That's just in general, whether we're talking about simple diffusion through the membrane or whether we're talking about using carrier proteins or some sort of proteins. But notice that the difference between the red and the dashed line is that if there's also galactose around, which can compete, then that's going to slow down the glucose transport because some of those carrier proteins are going to be locked up by galactose. That's competition. And finally, the third important property that mediated transport mechanisms exhibit is saturation. Saturation refers to fullness. And so if you think of these transport proteins as being turnstiles, you know, say if you're trying to get into Bank One Ballpark, for the diehard fans that get there early, there's going to be not so many of them around trying to get in the place. Very early, there's going to be more turnstiles than there are people showing up. And so nothing stops them from getting in. And if there are more people, but there's still enough turnstiles to go around, the more people there are, the faster they'll get in. Okay, that's why you see a steepening, that's why you see an increase in the rate of transport when you have an increase in concentration. But eventually you'll get to a point where the concentration of people trying to get in is so high that all of the turnstiles are being used. And then it levels off. It doesn't matter that there are still more and more people showing up. You can only let so many people in at a given time once all the turnstiles are full being used. And so that's completely analogous to all of a given cell's transport proteins being employed at any given instant. It doesn't matter what the gradient is at that point. If it gets higher, no more increase in the transport rate because you can only go so fast using transport proteins. Does that make sense? All right, so specificity, competition, and saturation, three important properties. Now 22 is a different kind of transport process. I mentioned it last time, but this is kind of a special case. This is vesicular transport. That's the general term for anything that happens like this. Vesicular is the adjective form. You don't see that very well, do you? The adjective form of vesicle. And a vesicle is a small sac. It's a small sac that a cell makes out of membrane. So you can contain something in the cell by putting a little layer of membrane, just like the plasma membrane around it. That is a vesicle. Vesicular transport can be either into or out of a cell, but it's kind of a cheating mechanism because vesicular transport is for things that are pretty big, too big even to get through, too big certainly to go through the phospholipid bilayer, and also too big to be carried by a protein or go through a channel protein. And so these things have to get into or out of the cell without actually going through the membrane, and that's why I say it's kind of a cheating mechanism. So what happens is that if it's an inward motion, it is called endocytosis. Endo meaning in and cyte meaning cell. That's what's happening right here on the left side of slide 22. A cell will engulf a particle by surrounding it until these cell processes that are trying to go around this particle touch each other and fuse together. Once they fuse together, the particle now is surrounded by plasma membrane that came from the cell. And once it pinches off, notice that you have a vesicle whose wall is made up of the plasma membrane of the original cell, and that vesicle is inside the cell, but notice that that particle really never crossed the membrane. Now it's just a matter of unzipping that vesicular membrane, opening it up, and then the particle is fully inside the cell. Okay, so that's endocytosis. And there are two kinds of endocytosis, phagocytosis and pinocytosis. The names of those differ only in the prefix. Phago means eat. Pino means drink. So cell eating and cell drinking, respectively. But these are both forms of endocytosis. You're either taking in a solid object or you're taking in a little packet of liquid to make it phago or pinocytosis. Slide 23 illustrates this process in more detail, but I don't want to get, why don't you get bogged down in the details? The thing I want you to get from 23 is that the membrane that makes up that vesicle for endocytosis was originally part of the full cell's plasma membrane, and that these things are recycled. Membranes are recycled. So you see the membrane of the vesicle is eventually, once the engulfed particles, these yellow diamonds, are taken out, some of that membrane gets put back into the plasma membrane. So there's continual recycling. And 24 shows you how this vesicular transport can be used to move something all the way through a cell. So you have a capillary endothelium cell in the middle of this figure that's actually forming the wall of a vessel, of a capillary. And something needs to go from the blood on the top to the interstitial fluid outside of the capillary. To do that, there's endocytosis on the blood side of that endothelial cell. That brings in the little, that forms the vesicle of whatever's being transported. That vesicle then travels along the cytoskeleton, which is inside of that endothelial cell. And then the vesicle fuses with the other sides, the cell's other side at the plasma membrane, and the process is reversed. It spills outward. That spilling outward is the opposite of endocytosis. It's exocytosis. All right? I don't think I want to mention anything about slide 25 because we've already talked about compartmentalization. So that brings us then to a quick overview of osmosis. Osmosis is actually a special case of diffusion. Remember, diffusion is a simple process, meaning that it doesn't require energy. Osmosis is a special case for a couple reasons. First, it is diffusion of water, but it's not just the diffusion of water. It's the diffusion of water across a selectively permeable membrane. And so remember, diffusion, when I gave you that beaker figure, diffusion can happen whether or not there's a membrane there. It can just happen from one space to another within one volume. But osmosis requires a selectively permeable membrane. Moreover, well, selectively permeable just means that some things get through that membrane, some don't. And the plasma membrane is an example of a selectively permeable membrane. Water, to a certain extent, is able to go through membranes, whereas certain solutes can't unless, well, they, unless they're aided by some protein. So if we just think about a piece of plasma membrane that is impermeable to these lavender spheres here, and there's a different concentration of these lavender spheres in these two solutions that are separated by the permeable membrane at the bottom of the U-tube, then just the concentration gradient that exists for these purple spheres sets up the tendency for these purple things to want to move from where there's more of them to where there's fewer of them, or where there's a higher concentration, I should say, to a lower concentration. So these purple spheres want to go to the left on your screen, but they're blocked by the membrane. They can't get through. On the other hand, water is able to get through. And water, you can think of water having its own concentration. Water is the solvent, whereas the purple things are the solutes. But think of it this way. If you have a solution of some of particle A, the more and more concentrated you get that solution, the more and more concentrated it is in particle A, the less and less watery it is, right? The more salt you add to a glass of water, the less watery it gets, the more salty it gets. So high solute concentration corresponds to low water concentration, right? And vice versa. So at this, there's two different gradients here, two different concentration gradients. There's one for the purple spheres, and there's one for water molecules. And they're in opposite directions, because the watery side of this is the left, so water wants to move to the right. At the same time, spheres want to move from right to left. Problem is, spheres can't move, water can, and so water is the only thing to move here. And that movement through the membrane is called osmosis. Now, notice that since water is the only thing moving, when it leaves the left side, it's going to reduce the volume of the left side. And since it's added to the right side, it's going to increase the volume of the right side. That's why the level goes from being the same on both sides to being lower on the left and higher on the right. And the higher that level on the right gets, the more it's affected by gravity, right? Gravity's pushing down on that right side more and more the taller it gets. So the force of osmosis is determined by the gradient. And notice that gradient is never going to go to zero. It's never going to, the gradient is never going to be eliminated. Oh, no, I guess it could be in this case. I'm sorry. If you had no purple spheres on the left to begin with, if it's just pure water on the left, it would be the same thing. But notice that no matter how much water goes to the right, you still have pure water on the left. So there would always be a gradient in place. You see what I'm saying? But it would never go to completion, because the force of osmosis, forcing water to the right, is being opposed by the force of gravitation, which is trying to squeeze water back to the left. And so this is a way of measuring what the osmotic force is, or the osmotic pressure if you divide that force by the area. It's whatever the force of gravity is when this thing comes to equilibrium. Okay? Does that make sense? I'll take that as a yes. All right, now, there's just a couple more terms you need to know from this transport chapter. What we have here is a cell placed into a beaker of solution. So the solution is surrounding the cell. And this is a selectively permeable membrane. What you have on part A of slide 27 is osmosis of water, because these ends represent, the N stands for non-penetrating or non-permeating solute. So these ends can't cross the membrane. And this is exactly the situation we just had in the U-tube. There's a concentration gradient with respect to N, though. It's higher N inside. than outside, and therefore lower water inside than outside. So water, since it's able to get through, moves inward. Whereas on the bottom of the figure, P stands for permeable. These things can permeate. Therefore, when there's a concentration gradient present, as there is in B, the way that concentration gradient is just simply dissipated by the diffusion of P out of the cell and into the beaker until it comes to equilibrium. Okay? That's why osmosis requires some sort of concentration gradient of a solute particle plus the inability of that solute particle to make it cross the membrane. I'm not going to say anything about 28. But let me get back to these final terms I mentioned. You see them here, hyposmotic, isosmotic, hyperosmotic. Iso means same, hyper means above, and hypo means below. So these are just words that are comparative, meaning they don't mean anything on their own. All of these words only make sense if you're comparing something to a cell. If a solution is isosmotic, it means that it has the same solute concentration as the cell's intracellular fluid does. That does not mean that it's the same solution. What I mean by that is that osmosis doesn't care what the non-permeating particles are. So you could have a solution of B particles in a beaker at concentration, at a concentration of 1, we'll say, just to give it a number. And the cell could have a concentration of 1, but for a different kind of particle, particle B. So they're totally different kinds of solutions because the solutes are different. But think about what that means for the water concentrations. If the concentrations are the same of the solutes, even though they're different, the water concentration is the same in both of them, and therefore there's no tendency for water to osmose. Okay, so it doesn't matter what the nature of the solute particles it is for osmosis to occur, it just matters what the concentration of total solute particles is. And if it's the same as the inside of a cell, then that solution is said to be isosmotic. If it has a higher solute concentration than a cell, then it's hyperosmotic, and if it has a lower solute concentration, it's hyposmotic. All right? Now, similar words are those same prefaces attached to the root tonic. Tonicity refers to the behavior of a cell that is placed in one of these three kinds of solutions. Okay? So tonicity doesn't make sense unless you're talking about a cell bathed by some sort of solution. If you put a cell into a hyposmotic solution, remember the hyposmotic solution has a lower solute concentration and therefore is more watery than the cell itself is. If you put a cell into a comparatively more watery solution, what happens to the cell? By osmosis. That water is going to move by osmosis from where there's more water to where there's less water, so it's going to go into the cell. That's going to swell the cell. Does that make sense? So a cell put into a hypotonic solution is going to swell. Now the plasma membrane is all animal cells have. They don't have a cell wall that can hold the pressure. So if it's hypotonic enough, then the cell is going to swell to the point of bursting. And that bursting is called lysis. On the other extreme, if you put a cell into a solution that has a higher solute concentration than the cell itself does, in other words, if you put it into a hypertonic solution, then water is going to leave the cell. And that's going to cause cell shrinkage, which is also damaging. That cell shrinkage is called crenation. But the ideal situation, of course, is to have the extracellular fluid, the stuff that is bathing the cells, to be isotonic. the same, an isotonic solution is not going to cause any net osmosis because the overall solute concentration is the same inside and out, even though they're different solutes. And that's what the situation has to be in your body. That's why extracellular fluids' overall solute concentration is an important thing for your body to adjust so that it's not drastically different from that of your cells, and therefore there's not loss or gain of water to the point of cell injury. Slide 31 has to do with membrane potentials, and I think I'm going to save that until we talk more about that on the nervous system. So let me skip the rest of that chapter's slides for now. Okay, any questions about this chapter? Then let us visit chapter 6. Chapter 6 is about cell-to-cell communication and signaling processes, signal pathways. This is important because an organism like you that is made up of literally tens of trillions of cells better have a way for those cells to know what's going on in neighboring cells. So in other words, there has to be a way for you to act as an entire organism, there has to be a way for cells to communicate. And slide 1 gives you a few ways that this occurs. One way is for there to be gap junctions between cells, and gap junctions have to be between adjacent cells, cells that are actually next to each other, because gap junctions are literally just little pores made out of proteins that are passageways from one cell to the other. So there's a passageway. The cytoplasm, it can communicate with the cytoplasm of the next cell by actually sending whatever kind of molecules or particles are able to go through those gap junctions. So not just anything gets through those gap junctions, but certainly some things do, and therefore these cells can communicate by exchanging materials. In B, you have contact-dependent signals. So different from gap junctions because you're not exchanging materials, but what you have here is that one cell will have a receptor protein with a specifically shaped receptor site on it, that's the yellow thing in B, that will be able to tell whether or not something with that correctly shaped ligand is present. The ligand, remember, is a word that just refers to anything that binds to a receptor. So the ligand in that one is the red thing. Since it fits nicely in that receptor site, the right cell is able to know that that left cell is present. Okay, so that's contact-dependent signals. Really, the same situation is occurring in C. It's just not because of contact. The cell, the ligand isn't part of the surface of a cell that's in contact with the receiving cell. In other words, these red ligands in C can be floating out anywhere. They can be broadcast through the circulatory system, for instance, be carried around in the blood. That's exactly what hormones are. There are signals like these red ligands here that are sent all the way through the body, and if they happen to encounter a cell that has the correctly shaped receptor, then that cell can have some sort of response to the binding event that occurs between that ligand and the receptor. Right, that's how chemical signals operate in general. Chemical signals operate based on the specificity between the shape of the ligand or the signal itself and the receptor that signal has to bind to for any signal transmission to occur. Slide 2 has three parts that show you different ways these chemical signals can be used. In the top are hormones. Now, these are functional distinctions, okay? This is a functional classification of chemical signals, by which I mean it only matters how they work. It doesn't matter at all what they're made of. As a matter of fact, as this figure implies, all three of these things can be exactly the same chemical. The red thing, the red diamonds here are, let's pretend, are exactly the same chemical. That's not what matters when we classify them as either hormone, neurotransmitter, or neurohormone. What matters is how they work. And hormones operate by being released eventually into the bloodstream. And since all cells of the body almost get a supply of blood, anything that is in the bloodstream is broadcast, meaning that it's sent everywhere, not specifically. It's like the difference between broadcast and cable as far as TV is concerned. Broadcast means it's just put out there, anything with the correct receiver will hit it. Cable is targeted to places, so it's specific. Well, the blood broadcasts hormones, and at capillaries where there are these fenestrae, little pores in capillaries' surface, fenestrae means windows, that's where these hormones can make their way out of the bloodstream, and they therefore get to encounter cells that are served by that capillary bed. Well, that doesn't mean that those cells are a target. They're not a target unless they happen to have the right kind of receptor. So the cell without the receptor there on the top has no response, even though that hormone is encountering that cell. Because the very first step in chemical signaling, and therefore if it doesn't happen, no effect will be felt, is the binding of that chemical signal to its receptor. All right? Part B are neurotransmitters. Neurotransmitters are classified functionally just on the basis of their origin. Neuro, part of that, refers to a neuron, which is a nerve cell. And neurotransmitters are released from what are called the presynaptic terminals at the end of a neuron. And those neurotransmitters don't travel very far. They diffuse across the tiny little space called the synaptic cleft, which is the space between the presynaptic terminal and whatever that postsynaptic cell is, which can itself be another neuron. They're not released into the bloodstream. They're therefore more like cable. They are targeted. They work only on whatever that downstream cell is, the target cell. And then they're quickly degraded or put back into the neurons, gotten rid of somehow so that they don't affect anything else. So even though it's exactly the same chemical, it's working in a different way. That's why it has a different functional classification. And neurohormones are kind of a mixture of the two. They're hormones because they go into the bloodstream, but instead of being released by an endocrine cell, which is what makes hormones, they're produced by a neuron. But all three of these functional classifications, they work the same way based on the specificity between the signal itself and a receptor. So the general pathway is shown in three. You have a signal molecule that has to bind to a receptor in order for anything else beyond that to happen. But if there is a binding, then that activates some sort of intracellular signal molecules. And intracellular, of course, just means inside the cell. And notice that this can happen even though the signal molecule never gets into the cell. Now, that's not to say that no signal molecule, some hormones can go into the cell. Lipid-based hormones, hormones that are made out of lipids, are able to go right through the plasma membrane. Why is that? are lipid-based hormones able to go through a plasma membrane? Because they are hydrophobic, right? They're nonpolar, hydrophobic molecules that have no problem being in the interior of that phospholipid bilayer. But amino acid-based hormones are hydrophilic, which means that they don't get through the membrane. And they cause things to happen inside the cell, even though they never enter the cell. But they do that because the protein to which they bind is a protein that extends all the way through the thickness of the membrane. And what happens in general when a ligand binds to a protein? What's the general response to the binding of a ligand to a receptor? There's a conformational change. And since that protein that's the receptor extends all the way through the thickness of the membrane, when it changes shape, the shape of the part that is facing the interior of the cell changes, and therefore it can cause things to happen inside the cell based on something attaching to the outside of it without that signal actually going through the membrane. But anyway, no matter whether the signal enters or does not enter the cell, there's something that happens inside the cell that is changed, and therefore that can cause still other things to change and so on. Eventually, no matter how many steps there are, eventually you'll get to something altering a target protein or even creating a protein, but I guess creation is an altering. And whatever that those target proteins are changed into, they will have some sort of function, which is the response. All right? So it's your proteins that really do all of the work in your cells. Those are the things that actually give you your characteristics. And sometimes proteins are activated, sometimes they're not. Whether or not they're activated depends on their shape, basically, or whether they have other sorts of particles attached to them. For instance, whether they're phosphorylated or not. Okay? And signals can cause changes in these proteins, which then have their effects. That's the response. Slide 4 gives you a picture of what I just talked about. Lipophilic signals. Lipophilic means lipid-loving. It's the same as hydrophobic, which is water-fearing. So there's four terms, but it's duplicated in meaning. Lipophilic is the same as hydrophobic. Lipophobic is the same as hydrophilic. Lipophilic signals, though, are lipid-based hormones, for instance. They can go right through. And the typical response on that, on a lipophilic chemical signal, is for genes to be activated. These lipophilic signals not only can get through a plasma membrane, they can get through any membrane because all membranes are phospholipid-based. And so a lipid hormone not only can get into the cell, it can get into the nucleus because it can cross that nuclear envelope, which is also made up of phospholipids. And so not all lipid hormones operate this way, but many do. They operate by binding to receptors inside the nucleus, where they will cause expression of a certain gene. By expression of a certain gene, I'm talking about initiation of transcription of a single gene. Do you remember what transcription and translation are? From 188? Transcription is the creation of an mRNA transcript, a piece of RNA, from a little section of DNA called a gene. What's the functional description of a definition of a gene? It's one piece of a chromosome, enough nucleotides long, in order to have the instruction for how to build a single protein. So protein synthesis consists of two steps. Transcription, which is taking that DNA and making it into RNA. That RNA transcript then travels out of the nucleus into the cytoplasm, where it goes to what structure? Where does translation take place? Onto a ribosome, right. Ribosomes then undergo translation, which is using the information in the nucleotide sequence of the mRNA transcript and making a protein one amino acid at a time, which is dictated by that sequence of nucleotides. All right, so that's what a lot of these lipid-based hormones or chemical signals do. They turn on genes and therefore create the proteins that those genes are coding for. And this takes a little bit of time. So this is kind of it's a comparatively slow reaction, a slow effect to these lipid-based hormones. On the other hand, a lipophobic or hydrophilic signal can't get into the cell, has to bind to a surface receptor, and that surface receptor then has to employ what is called a second messenger, some other intracellular molecule that gets changed somehow, and it can have several steps. There can be another messenger, and so on until you finally get usually activation of or deactivation of an enzyme. Enzymes are proteins. They're not the only kind of proteins that are altered. It could be any kind of protein, but typically it's an enzyme that either gets turned on or turned off. And that's important because without enzymes, whatever the biochemical pathway is that enzyme affects gets shut down or gets turned on, because these biochemical pathways that make up metabolism don't happen on their own very readily. That's the whole reason enzymes are so important to life. They allow it to happen, but they also control the rates. Okay, slide 5 shows you some different kinds of surface receptors. Some gated channels, as you see on the left, are classified as ligand-gated channels. Some books call ligand-gated channels chemically-gated channels. That just refers to the fact that what opens or closes the gate is a ligand binding somewhere to the surface. Now, that's just one kind of gated channel. There are also, for instance, voltage-gated channels that don't operate on the basis of a ligand. They operate on the basis of a membrane potential. But that's one way for an extracellular signal molecule to have an effect inside. It can open up a receptor channel. Now, it's important to realize here that a ligand-gated channel, for the operation of a ligand-gated channel, it's not the ligand that goes through the channel. The ligand is just the key that opens up the gate. Whatever particle that gated channel is specific for will go through it. All right, so this could be, for instance, a ligand-gated sodium ion channel. Now, if that ligand-gated sodium ion channel is opened up, sodium ions go through it only if what is true. Just the fact that a channel is open doesn't mean that there's any net diffusion. What do you have to have in place for a diffusion to occur? A gradient. And why do you always have a sodium ion gradient? Because of the operation of the sodium-potassium exchange pumps for your entire life. About 40% of your metabolism is devoted just to running those pumps. All right? In other words, that's about half of the reason why you eat. So, if it were sodium ions, which way would they flow once the gate is open? They would go into the cell because that's the way the gradient operates. Right. Okay, there are also receptor enzymes, which are just proteins that have a receptor on the exterior surface, but on the surface that's facing the interior of the cell, that part of the protein acts as an enzyme, and therefore has another receptor site called the active site. That's what the receptor site of an enzyme is called in general, the active site. That's where the substrate can bind to. The substrate is the thing, the chemical that an enzyme binds to in order to cause the change. All right, so that can happen. You also have G protein coupled receptors. A lot of signal pathways employ what are called G proteins. and they have all kinds of different effects, but they really all start out the same way. A G protein is really a complex of three proteins on the interior surface of the plasma membrane that are associated with a transmembrane protein shown in the brown. That's the receptor protein. It's transmembrane, meaning that it goes all the way through the thickness. You notice that all of these things are transmembrane. They have to be in order for a change to occur inside the cell based on something that's happening outside of the cell. But we'll look at more particulars of the G protein later. And then the final one is an integrin receptor. This integrin is a transmembrane protein that is somehow associated with the cytoskeleton. The cytoskeleton is a whole complex of proteins that the cell's interior uses as internal support, scaffolding, and basically roadways. Things are shuttled around into a cell, not just by floating around, they're actually shuttled around on little protein roads using motor proteins. And since the integrin is associated with the cytoskeleton, the signal can cause something to happen inside the cytoskeleton. Okay, now signal transduction, slide 6. Let me just define transduction. Transduction is simply the conversion of one type of signal into another. And you see here the analogy is radio waves, which are electromagnetic radiation, invisible light. It's exactly like the light you see. It's just a different wavelength, much longer wavelengths. And that kind of energy is received by the radio, but then it's transduced into a different kind of signal. It's transduced into an alternating current electrical signal, which then causes the magnet of the loudspeaker to pull and alternatingly pull and push the cone, which produces a pressure wave in the air, which is what actually travels to your ear and then further gets transduced into electrochemical energy in your head. So there's a lot of transduction steps actually, but the point is that transduction is simply changing the type of the signal into another. And this occurs in cells as well. So transduction occurs in this complex that involves the receptor, the transducer, and the amplifier. Now, the amplification I haven't mentioned yet. Amplification occurs in cell signal transductions, especially in the case of lipophobic signals or hydrophilic signals, the ones that don't get into the cell can feature a hell of a lot of amplification. And I'll show you why, hopefully, with a slide. The slide 7 shows you a little bit of amplification. This is a typical lipophobic signal. It can't get into the cell, binds to an external receptor, and that causes something just inside the cell to happen. It activates something, we'll say. That something is usually an enzyme. An enzyme, once it's activated, is able to catalyze whatever reaction it's specific for. But a single, the reason that the ultimate signal, I mean the ultimate effect is amplified, is that one individual signal molecule here, the yellow diamond, by binding, is able to activate multiple enzymes just inside the cell. Each of those multiple enzymes is then able to catalyze multiple reactions, which might be activating enzymes further downstream. Each step is a multiplication, and therefore you have a hell of a lot of result in response to just a single signal molecule. And since you might be starting out with millions of signal molecules, you multiply millions by many more millions, you're talking about a huge response because of this amplification. And this amplification is called the cascade effect. You don't see this so much with lipophilic signal pathways because they don't involve as many steps. So you might think it's wasteful to have so many steps, whereas you could just cut out the middleman and go to the effect, but each step adds the potential for more amplification. And even though these are a lot more steps than you have in lipophilic signals, this takes place quickly because most of these enzymes are already in the cell, ready to go. They just need to be activated. Whereas with lipophilic ones, if they are activating genes, those proteins that cause the response have to actually be manufactured, and that takes a lot longer. Slide 8 gives you a generalized scheme of what can happen here with signal molecules attaching to external or membrane-bound receptors. You have amplifier enzymes, as I just mentioned, that affect in one way or another these second messenger molecules. Well, these second messenger molecules, there's various classes of them. An important class are protein kinases, as you see in blue there. The kine part of that is the same root as in kinetic energy, which is the same root as cinema, meaning moving, right? Moving pictures or energy of movement is kinetic energy. Protein kinases are things that activate proteins, get them moving, in other words. And typically this is done via phosphorylation. So protein kinases are things that phosphorylate other things. And those other things are typically proteins that can act as enzymes if they are phosphorylated. But what does it mean to phosphorylate something? Simply to add a phosphate to it. All right, so ATP, for instance, which has three phosphates on it, is able to phosphorylate things if it breaks one of those phosphate bonds and puts that free phosphate onto something else. Well, protein kinases can do this as well. Another, though, is calcium ions can act as important second messenger molecules. And they do this by binding to calcium binding proteins, as you see here, which changes the function of those proteins. Whether proteins are bound to calcium or not affects what those proteins do. And so one way or another you get a cell response, but those are two main ways that cell responses can be achieved. Slide 9 illustrates a pathway. This is a signal pathway. It's very rare for there to just be a simple A to B chain of events. Usually a cell response occurs at the end of a long chain of reactions. Usually not just one reaction. The first reaction causes a second reaction to occur. In other words, the first reaction, just like any chemical reaction, has a reactant or reactants and a product. Whatever that product is typically serves as the reactant for a second pathway. And then it's going to have its own product. That product then is the reactant for a third reaction and so on. From initial stimulus to product takes several steps. Each individual step is its own chemical reaction, and just like all chemical reactions in cells, it is each individual step is catalyzed by its own enzyme. Well, notice that if you shut down any one of these individual chemical reactions, you shut down the entire pathway. So this gives the cell a lot of power to control this overall pathway, because it's up to the cell whether or not these proteins exist that are acting as the enzymes. And just because they exist doesn't mean they necessarily are working as enzymes. They have to be activated. And they're activated or deactivated based on the presence or absence of signals that are coming from outside the cell. So you see how communication can drastically affect what's happening inside a cell. What do we have? Okay. We go to 8:45, right? Okay. All right, slide 10. This tyrosine kinase protein that you see here in red is an enzyme, and you know that linguistically because it ends in ASE. Enzymes names usually end in ASE, like sodium, potassium, ATPase. And usually the name of an enzyme, other than the ASE part, either indicates what the substrate is, meaning it tells you what that enzyme acts on, or it tells you what that enzyme does. Okay, so tyrosine kinase is an example of a kinase, which I just described a couple slides ago. Remember that kinases phosphorylate things. So the active site of tyrosine kinase is only active if it has the right shape. But it doesn't have the right shape to do the catalysis that it achieves unless the signal molecule is bound to the exterior portion, the receptor site. So if that L molecule happens to be around at the time, it will bind to the receptor site on R, but the R and the TK are all really one protein. The tyrosine kinase then will change shape because of that binding event between L and R, and that gives the active site of tyrosine kinase the right shape for its substrate to fit in, which is some sort of protein that, along with ATP lending one of its phosphates, will result in a phosphorylated protein. All right? And what happens to ATP? What does it become? ADP, adenosine diphosphate, because it's lost one of its phosphates. Now, phosphorylated proteins, don't think of it as being a rule that phosphorylation activates an enzyme. That's often the case. But you could, there are some enzymes that, when they're phosphorylated, are turned off. So it could work either way. But whichever way it works always that way for that enzyme. Slide 11 is a better illustration of the cascade effect than I showed you before, because it shows you that each individual step results in amplification, because each particle in each step can activate several particles in the next step. And so one single molecule, which would never occur, it would never operate with just one signal molecule, but just a single molecule to illustrate the effect results in however many of these green molecules there are inside at the bottom. A drastic amplification. Oh, another thing that slide 11 shows you is that cyclic AMP is just one of many second messengers, but it's an important messenger. It's used in a lot of pathways. This one happens to involve also a G protein. And like I said, what G proteins do depends on weight, where they are. They can do a lot of things, but in this specific example, the activated G protein, which is the G protein once the ligand signal molecule is bound, the G protein gets dissociated from the receptor protein and travels to a nearby adenylyl cyclase in this case. Notice the ASE ending, that's another enzyme. But adenylyl cyclase is an important enzyme because of the fact that cyclic AMP is an important messenger. And adenylyl cyclase, once it's activated, is the enzyme that converts ATP into cyclic AMP. Okay? So notice that there's activation of adenylyl cyclase in response to the G protein being activated. The G protein isn't activated until the signal molecule joins to the outside of the cell. But then once adenylyl cyclase is activated, that creates cyclic AMP, which itself is a signal inside the cell. And then you have several more steps. Each one involves an amplification because it's a cascade of signals. Another G protein is illustrated in slide 12. This is not really so much a specific example as to just show you that G proteins can be either associated with or dissociated with dissociated from whatever receptor that they're involved with. And that's what activation of G proteins always results in. Whenever the signal molecule binds to the outside of the cell, a G protein gets uncoupled from that receptor molecule. And the subunits of that G protein, there's an alpha, beta, and a gamma subunit. That's why G proteins are usually shown in three parts here, which it shows you on slide 12. The alpha subunit of that dissociates and does something. Like in the last slide, it activated adenylyl cyclase. Here, it's showing you that G proteins can also travel to nearby channel proteins and open them up. Now this channel protein that's shown here is trying to tell you that ion channels can be opened up either by ligands outside the cell, in which case it would be a ligand-gated ion channel, or they can be opened from the inside by a G protein that is activated by some ligand binding to the outside. They have the same effect. Once the channel's open, the channel's open, and whatever ions that channel is specific for will flow. But you can open up a ligand-gated channel in a couple different ways. The reason that ion channels, by the way, are so important is because anytime an ion channel is open, ions flow, of course, as long as there's a gradient in place, and there always is because of the pumps. And the reason ion flow through a membrane is so important is that it changes the distribution of electric charge across the membrane. And that distribution of electric charge is called the membrane potential, which is a voltage. Potential is actually shorthand for electrical potential gradient, but we just say potential. It is potential energy, though, as the name implies. And another name for electrical potential gradient is voltage, just like when we talk about voltage at your house. There's a gradient of electrons when we talk about a voltage in household wiring. For a cell, there's a gradient of charge, not in the form of electrons, which do, of course, carry charge, but in the form of ions. All right, so that's why we have electrical signals in our bodies. It's because we have voltages, real voltages in our body, but not because of just bare electrons, rather by distribution of ions, which are much bigger than electrons, right? They still carry positive or negative charges, though, and so they are electrical. Well, that gets changed. The voltage that you can measure across a membrane can be does change whenever you redistribute ions. And the way that ions are redistributed, since they can't go, since they're charged, they can't go right through the phospholipid bilayer, the way they're distributed, redistributed, is for ion channels to be opened up. Some of these ion channels are ligand gated, meaning that they will respond to a chemical signal. If a chemical signal opens them up, then the direct result of that chemical signal is a change in the membrane potential, or the voltage. And that voltage change can therefore then have other effects, profound effects, as we'll see. But there are also ion channels, as I mentioned, that are voltage gated, meaning that the key that opens up certain channels is not a ligand that binds to it. It's not a chemical signal. Rather, it is a certain value of the membrane potential, a certain voltage. And so that's why you could have the situation of a ligand-gated ion channel being opened up in response to a chemical signal. That will redistribute ions to the point that the voltage changes to a certain value that will kick open still other ion channels that are voltage-gated. Does that make sense at all? And when that happens, this is exactly how the nervous system and the muscular system operate. This is how action potentials are created. Ligand-gated ion channels open up, causing a redistribution of ions that is a change in voltage. That change in voltage will open up voltage-gated ion channels that causes even more ion flow. And it's a chain of a reaction that occurs down the length of these comparatively long cells, either neurons or myofibers. More about that later, but there are these different kinds of gated ion channels. And actually there is a third kind that are mechanically gated ion channels. Mechanically gated ion channels respond to deformation of some sort. Whether they're pushed or pulled or somehow deformed, they will open up or close depending on the situation. Okay? And that's distinct from the other two types. All right. This last slide that I'm going to talk about, slide 13, pulls all of this together. It really isn't new information. This just is a schematic of everything I've been talking about for the last several slides. But notice that the cellular responses that any of these various things can cause come in a few varieties. Motor proteins are proteins, as the name implies, that move things around. When I talked earlier about things being moved along the roadways that the cytoskeleton forms, it literally is things being walked along microtubules. Microtubules are certain kind of proteins that make up the cytoskeleton. And there are motor proteins that actually bind and unbind along the length, walking whatever they're carrying from one place to another in the cell. That's one example of what a motor protein does. But motor proteins are always involved in moving things somehow. Enzyme activity is affected if the protein that gets changed in the end happens to be an enzyme. And that enzyme, of course, will catalyze whatever it's specific for. All enzymes are catalysts. But there can also be a change in membrane receptors and transporters. And an example of this would be that membrane receptors are, of course, proteins that are embedded in the membrane. But the plasma membrane is a highly dynamic structure. It's always changing. So the cell can adjust for instance, its sensitivity to signals outside the cell by adjusting how many or how few of the receptor proteins it embeds in the plasma membrane, which could actually be the result of some other signal. All right, so that's one way that there can be an ultimate effect. And then gene activity and protein synthesis, I already talked about. That is usually, but it doesn't have to be, that's usually in response, though, to lipophilic